On the 27th of October is the first annual Portland Psychedelic Conference. And could you tell me a little bit about where that's going to be, what people can expect if they attend?
Of course. It's going to be here in Portland, Oregon at the Alberta Abbey. And we're going to have a lineup of speakers, PhDs, people specialized in naturopaths and healing medicines and such. And our keynote speaker is Dennis McKenna, who is among the leading visionaries pretty much in this whole field. So we are offering continued education credits to mental health care professionals, and we're also working on continuing education for naturopaths. But that one we won't know the answer to until October 8th.
Thank you, Jason. So we are also joined today by a couple of the speakers who will be at the conference, Dr. Erica Zelfand.
Hello.
And Dr. Alyssa Bazinet.
Hello.
Dr. Bazinet, you will be speaking about the potential use of MDMA in the treatment of PTSD?
Yes, that's correct. So there is currently a research study that's being conducted through the Multidisciplinary Association on Psychedelic Studies. They are in phase three of a FDA clinical trial to approve MDMA as a medication used in as an adjunct to psychotherapy in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'll be speaking on the current research that's been done so far and what the future looks like for therapists who are interested in using this intervention with their patients with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, and just sort of a thumbnail sketch, what does that future look like if it is approved by the FDA?
So mental health professionals who are licensed are able to undergo training currently through the Multidisciplinary Association on Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS as they're commonly known, to go through and learn how to do the therapy. You would need to have a medical provider who can carry a Schedule I license to actually prescribe the MDMA, but the therapist would be using that in a psychotherapy protocol with clients in their practices.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but would this be a particularly big break with accepted treatments for PTSD?
Yes, absolutely. The data is looking that way so far. So the effect sizes on the published studies that have been completed are much larger than the traditionally accepted therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder that currently exist. I do want to be careful in noting that many of the treatments that have been developed are certainly effective for a significant portion of people who are diagnosed with PTSD, but there is room for improvement. So for a lot of people, they are not getting better, or we're just not able to kind of offer a long enough time period working with them. So this is definitely a unique and different intervention.
If I can piggyback on that, I'll also mention that the clinical trials are specifically on patients that have treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder, meaning that they have tried other therapies that have not, for one reason or another, worked for them. And that one out of every three military deaths is due to suicide. So this is an issue that has captured the attention of many mental health care providers, as well as the military is quite invested in seeing novel breakthrough therapies that can help with post-traumatic stress disorder.
So Dr. Zelfand, before we get into like what a session like that might actually look like, I was wondering, could you tell us a little about the history of the psychedelic sciences?
Sure. Well, the history is long and juicy and interesting, and there actually was a rather rich, what was beginning to become a whole field here of psychedelic healing, and there was a big halt that happened on that research due to changes in drug law and policy in the United States, and we went through this period of dark ages where all of the work went underground. It didn't stop necessarily, it just got quiet, and studies weren't being published, and the people that were doing this work were doing so really risking their own safety, their own medical licenses if they had them. And now we're having this renaissance of psychedelic healing, where we are actually once again having clinical trials happening above board, and we're able to revisit some of these old studies and reproduce them or create new studies now demonstrating their efficacy. And the first person to win FDA approval since the 1960s was Charles Grob, and he did a pilot study on psilocybin in the treatment of depression and anxiety in cancer patients. And his trial was followed by larger randomized double-blind crossover phase two trials. These were done at Johns Hopkins and NYU in 2016. And these were the kind of big studies that got picked up by a lot of media in patients that had a terminal or life-threatening diagnosis such as cancer and a concurrent depression or anxiety diagnosis. Those patients were treated with psilocybin, which is the active constituent of magic mushrooms, as it's called on the street. And that really, there were other studies that happened, but the scientific rigor of those studies, the large scale of the studies, and just to be frank, the fancy names of the universities associated with those studies were really what started catching the attention of people that were interested in this work, and quite frankly, people that weren't. And now we're having a total psychedelic renaissance, in large part thanks to the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, which is funding a lot of this work.
Okay. And what's the state of the legality of any of this treatment?
So as of this moment, none of this work, none of these medicines are legal, to the best of my knowledge, outside of the context of a FDA-approved clinical trial.
Okay.
So that being said, those are happening. So we are having FDA-approved clinical trials involving these medicines. Hopefully, these medicines will prove to be as efficacious as we believe that they are. And over time, that will lead to the rescheduling of these medicines. So they will be moved from Schedule 1. FDA Schedule 1 means that a drug has no approved use with no medical value. So hopefully, these substances will get rescheduled, and from there, they will be able to be prescribed accordingly. We're really hoping this is going to go a lot differently than marijuana has, which has been legalized by some states but still remains on the federal Schedule 1, along with heroin. I'll save my comments and opinions about that. Mm-hmm. But hopefully this is going to have a different trajectory.
So an actual treatment session, I'm guessing that depending on the what's being treated and the particular substance that is being used, that it would be different from situation to situation. What would an actual treatment session look like using, for example, MDMA?
Yeah, so you're right that it would depend on, you know, what the indication is that we're treating. So with post-traumatic stress disorder, there are actually three separate types of sessions that would take place in using this particular protocol. So the first would just be preparatory sessions, so meeting with the client, telling them what to expect from the substance, what to expect from what might come up for them emotionally, and just kind of working through the logistics of how that will go so they know what to expect when they're given the substance. And then the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session itself. So it's an 8-hour long session. Typically, there are two therapists that are involved in treating the person. And so they take the substance and are, you know, engaged in psychotherapy for 8 hours straight with this therapy dyad. And then afterwards, there is what's called integration sessions. So that's where a lot of work is done to process what came up during the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session and work with the material that's arising as a result of that.
And can you talk a little bit about that term integration a little bit more? What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, so integration is essentially taking the material, emotional material that came up during the session with the MDMA and working with that to help the person figure out what that means for their life. So often really intense emotion arises that they may have not been in touch with previously. And so techniques are worked with them to figure out, you know, how to handle that emotion, how to develop coping skills, how to integrate that into their daily lives,
just so
and improve their functioning. So it's just an opportunity to work with that material more deeply. Oftentimes when the person is in an altered state, when they're given the MDMA, things come up that they may not immediately remember without some active processing because their cognition is such that it's not operating as it would, you know, at their normal baseline without being in an altered state. Okay. And so they're working with that material to kind of solidify it for themselves as they go about their daily lives.
And that touches on something that you'll be speaking about, Dr. Zelfand, the balance between that mystical experience aspect of it and the medical treatment aspect of it and how those reconcile.
Yes, absolutely. With psychedelic research, what they found is that giving people acid or mushrooms and then putting them in a sterile room in a clinic with fluorescent lights and no windows didn't really yield very good outcomes. That is really where the importance of set and setting comes in with this medicine. The setting that the person is actually in when they take the medication, as well as the mind frame that they are in. The way that that translates here with psychedelics is it really speaks to the fact that, yes, these substances work very powerfully on altering brain chemistry. They directly affect neurotransmitter receptor sites, and we know this. In fact, there was one study, which I just would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for this study, done by neuropsychopharmacologist Robin Carhart-Harris through the Beckley Imperial Research Program in 2016, where they actually did put a bunch of people in fMRI machines, and they did brain scans on them, and then they pulled them out of the machines, and then they gave them all a hit of acid or LSD. And during sometime in the 6 hours in which they were tripping, they put them back in the machines and redid their brain scans. And what they, just the sort of baseline and the before and after photos, I really would advise folks listening to look these up because they are just phenomenal, the difference between the brain scans. But what they found is that we have this objective data that shows different parts of the brain are suddenly able to communicate in ways that they weren't able to before, and that's called crosstalk. And there's also decreased activity in the region of the brain called the default mode network, and that's a region of the brain that's always humming in the background with this just whatever your background story is, like I'm a loser, or nobody likes me, or things you're worried about. And it's thought that people with depression, anxiety, mental illness have hyperactive default mode network activity. So we have these beautiful images showing, quite frankly, that that's getting turned down and crosstalk is happening. And we know that, you know, these receptor sites get activated. And I'll talk about the details of that next month at the conference. But what we also have are other studies showing that it doesn't matter. I'm just going to use casual talk here because it's just going to make more sense. It doesn't matter how hard somebody trips when they are on a psychedelic substance. Whether they have a intense trip or a very mild trip doesn't so much influence the therapeutic outcome of the medicine. What does seem to influence the success, however, is whether or not they have a mystical experience while they were under the effects of the medicine. And one example of this is there was a smoking cessation study, which showed that when people were on psilocybin, if they had a profound spiritual experience, they were more likely to successfully quit smoking and be smoke-free at 12-month follow-up, regardless of if they, quote-unquote, tripped hard. And actually, one of the researchers behind that study, Albert Garcia Ramu, is also going to be speaking at the conference next month as well. So we have they seem like they would be conflicting mechanisms here, where one is very objective, neurochemical, neuroplastic oriented, and the other is, well, people just feel that they're one with everything and they're connected with God and they have a spiritual experience. And psychedelic therapy, so far as I know, is one of the only therapies that really merges the two and honors both in how it works. And I think that's part of why these medicines are able to access deeper levels of healing than a lot of the other therapies that we have available to us.
That's very interesting. As anyone knows who's experienced that sort of thing, it's hard, if not impossible, to deny that mystical experience, but I'm sure that it can be a hard thing to work into a medical framework?
Yeah, it really takes objective, data-driven, left-brain scientific folk out of their comfort zone. But it is this component that we really can't ignore in psychedelic research.
I'll open this to the table. Is there any real concerted opposition to this research and the possible course that it could take in the medical community?
I haven't seen any direct opposition to it, but it's still very early. But I do see work like MAPS, which has been referenced here a few times. They're gaining steam, and I'm seeing their name more and more. And that's do you know what MAPS stands for?
Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies.
Yeah, and that's a pretty much a pretty major one. And here in Oregon, we have Oregon Psilocybin Society just got an initiative through for a bill for psilocybin being legal here in Oregon in 2020. We're collecting signatures on that now. So I haven't seen the opposition yet. It really feels like it's gaining momentum and not the other way.
A big purpose of the upcoming conference, which, and I want to get into this in a little bit, but is the first one, right, of the first annual conference?
I've only been volunteering with this Psychedelic Society here for a few months this summer, but this is the first time that they've had a full conference. However, earlier this week, we had Paul Stamets speaking at the Newmark Theater as part of one of our events, and that was sold out and pretty major. But we do have big events, we have small events all the time, but this is the first conference, as we say. But as a community organization, we have small events, we have big speakers, we're trying to do like movie nights, comedy nights, really get people from Portland all together to really open up and speak or be able to ask questions with people in the community who have actually sat with the medicines or know the people, have the direct experience.
So what are some current opportunities for professionals to get trained to learn about this, these new treatments or potential treatments, or to just sort of open their minds to this avenue of treatment?
So there is a certificate program that I'm aware of through the California Institute of Integral Studies in the Bay Area. And this is a program it's a certificate program for licensed professionals, so mental health professionals that already have their degree and their ability to practice, to learn all about the history of psychedelic therapy, all of the different sorts of psychedelic therapies that will be available once legalized, to learn about all of the research that's happening. And so I know that that's one formal way of getting trained. MAPS as well, when there's a program called Expanded Access that will be is being applied for towards the end of this year or the beginning of next year, and therapists will be able to apply to go through the training, the MAPS official training, to learn how to use MDMA with the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy protocol for PTSD. So those are a couple of the opportunities, the formal opportunities that I'm aware of that exist.
I think we didn't talk too much about what Dr. Bazinet, how MDMA can benefit somebody through treatment. What does that engage that other treatments don't?
So it really seems to serve as a catalyst for people to really get to a place where they're able to build a trusting rapport with the therapist. So people with a diagnosis of PTSD, they've been traumatized. So it's often very, very difficult to open up and talk about those traumatic experiences because our brain and our bodies, everything in us wants to avoid being with those experiences because they're very terrible and, upsetting experiences. And so MDMA really allows participants to feel more open, to feel trusting, to feel safe. It's really about safety. And so therapeutic processes can work more effectively in that kind of environment.
Okay.
And with traditional treatments, oftentimes people are, not returning for sessions, or it's just taking a very, very long time to build the kind of rapport that can be built with an MDMA-assisted session in just that 8 hours.
So the flip side of this is that may not be right for everybody. In the context of MDMA specifically, is there people who this treatment most likely would not benefit?
Currently, the treatment is being used for, only in post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also been a few smaller studies on social anxiety for adults on the autism spectrum, as well as anxiety associated with life-threatening illness. There's also a study being done with individuals who are in a couple where one member of the couple has PTSD. So those are the current like known indications where this therapy is being investigated. In the MAP studies, there are a couple of diagnoses that are ruled out when people are calling in and screened to be in the study. And those are people with schizophrenia-like disorders as well as bipolar disorder. And at this point, we just don't know enough about how MDMA might work in those populations. So it's not that they could never, ever be appropriate. It's just that there's too much risk involved at this point in time.
Jason, so the Portland Psychedelic Society, you have the big conference coming up on October 27th.
Yes.
At the Alberta Abbey.
Yes.
At which people can come here, Doctors Bazinet and Zelfand and five other folks speak.
I believe there's a total of seven, including our keynote speaker and the doctors here today.
Great. And in the meantime, if people want to get involved, what's sort of the next opportunity? What's going on around town?
What's next is here Wednesday. We have a place we meet up near Foster Powell called the Bush Street Wellness Center. One of the therapists, doctors who are speaking at our conference actually has an ongoing series there. She'll be teaching journaling on Wednesday, and then on Sunday at the same place, her integration into psycho-spiritual series, which really teaches people how to a lot of technique into integrating. Like they said, you have these experiences, but then what does that mean for the rest of your life? You have to adapt the rest of your life to what you learned, or you lead towards this path. So she has a great series there. We'll be meeting at Bush Street. We also have more stuff coming up in October. You just the best thing to do is follow us on Meetup or Facebook, or we're starting off a Reddit now too. So if you're on any of those, just find Portland Psychedelic Society, and it's just, we keep stuff really interesting, at least three things a month. Yeah.
Great. I wanted to thank everybody again for coming down to KBOO today and talking about this. It's
Thanks
one of those topics that's, you scratch the surface and there's just so much underneath there.
Yeah.
But is there anything that anyone would like to add before we wrap up, or important things that I missed? Dr. Zelfand, you've got your hand raised.
I would, yes, to piggyback on Dr. Bazinet talking about just, the risks and maybe who shouldn't be doing this. I think something important worth mentioning here is that all of the clinical trials we have on psychedelic medicine are pairing psychedelic medicine use with therapy or some kind of other therapeutic intervention. And so these substances behave a lot differently depending on the environments and settings in which they're used. So taking LSD or mushrooms at a music festival can still create a powerful healing experience, or it can create just a really fun weekend, or it can create a bad trip that can be traumatizing. And the very same substances, when used within the context of a therapeutic relationship in a controlled environment, can create rather different and deeply profound healing for individuals. So I also do just want to caution listeners to not just go out and buy a bunch of these illicit substances and just take them at a party to see what happens, and to really be careful and mindful in how they're used, because they're powerful tools.
Thank you.
And I'd like to just add one more small note to piggyback off what you're saying, Dr. Zelfand, which is that also be careful about people out there who are offering therapeutic services in use with these substances, because there are a lot of so-called underground guides and sitters and whatnot. And while some of those situations can potentially be, safe set and setting, there's a lot of unsafe situations as well. So just be discerning if that's something that listeners are out there seeking to do.
And I think that really speaks to the importance of this work becoming legal to protect the end user.
Absolutely.
I've been speaking today with Drs. Alyssa Bazinet and Erica Zelfand, who will be speaking at the first annual Portland Psychedelic Conference, put on by the Portland Psychedelic Society. And we have Jason Harris in the house from the Portland Psychedelic Society. thank you to all three of you for coming down to KBOO today and talking to me.
Thank you. And just a reminder to the audience, tickets are still on sale, but this will sell out. So if you're hearing this today, get them, because we had people for a month asking us for the Paul Stamets tickets, and we don't have as many of these as we had for that even. So
thanks so much.
Thank you, everybody. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.